This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University student leader Angel Zamudio says apartment owners have an unflattering image of students.
They kind of use students as like piggy banks, in a sense. Like, they can milk us out for as much as they want.
With a new university housing complex coming, Ryan Denham reports there might be disruption to the image and to the apartment marketplace. Plus, there's a shortage of referees for youth games across Illinois. Eric Stock reports on the trend. And Billy Tyus, the new deputy city manager for Bloomington, introduces himself. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. For years, Illinois State University has been knocking down old dorms and nudging its sophomores, juniors, and seniors into off-campus apartments. Developers and landlords looking to make a buck responded by building more apartment buildings, luring students with fancy amenities and names like The Lodge and The Summit. All that could soon be flipped upside down. GLT's Ryan Denham has this report.
ISU is pivoting back to on-campus housing. The university is looking to partner with a developer for a public-private partnership that would add up to 1,200 beds, a 20% increase in in-campus housing. Tuesday is the deadline for developer proposals, and ISU wants to have its new housing project built in time for the fall 2021 semester. This change in direction would disrupt the off-campus student housing market. Landlords say vacancies will rise as more students stay on campus, cutting into their revenue and increasing the likelihood for dilapidation or even foreclosures. Some say they were surprised by ISU's abrupt shift in housing philosophy and want more information.
I wish we knew more about it. It's been very under the radar, kind of a secretive thing.
That's Ed Sauter. He's the owner of The Summit, the $4 million-plus student apartment building that opened last year. Sauter has owned apartments locally since attending ISU in the 1970s.
We're a little bit disappointed that we didn't. There wasn't some communication between the university and the support community as to where they're going. So initial thought was, we're always glad for good things to happen at ISU, for growth to come about. We also somewhat question why they're going back into the real estate business when they made a major plunge away from it a few years ago and kind of turned it over to the private sector.
The off-campus student housing business has changed drastically in the last decade when ISU closed and later demolished two giant dorms and pushed 1,500 students into the private sector. Townwide, Normal has seen 64 new apartment buildings with over 1,200 units built over the last decade, many for the ISU market. 20 years ago, 40% of undergrads at ISU lived on campus. Now it's about 30%. Landlords say the apartment market is already saturated, especially after the fall 2018 openings of The Summit, Stadium Suites across from Hancock Stadium, and a major expansion of The Lodge on Willow. Here's Tom O'Rourke, owner of Redbird Property Management, with 310 student apartments.
We're overbuilt right now. There's lots of vacancies on campus as we speak.
There are many reasons for ISU's shift in housing strategy, informed in part by a 2018 study from a consultant. ISU Vice President for Student Affairs, Lavester Johnson, says it found ISU lacks enough on-campus housing for sophomores.
We are expecting fewer people graduating actually from high school. Competition is as strong as it's ever been amongst and between institutions, and therefore we have to make sure we're upping our game in order to just maintain where we're at enrollment wise. So, and I think this plays into that as far as providing quality facilities for our students.
Johnson says ISU has no plans to drastically grow total enrollment beyond the 20,000 to 21,000 range where it is now. So I asked Johnson, as the supply and demand equation changes, what's ISU's message to off-campus landlords?
Yeah, I think that there would be opportunities for them as it relates to upper-class students. and graduate students in that sense, providing options for our students. I think, again, just as we remain concerned about making sure that the quality and the level of the student experience that we provide within our residential environments is at the top of what should be provided on college campuses in order to retain them. I think I would have our partners within the community who are housing our students consider that just as we are, and maybe the focus shifts a little bit more then to upgrading and maintaining whatever existing facilities that they have and providing the highest quality that they might be able to do as well.
Ed Sauter says the off-campus housing market now has an occupancy rate of around 90%. If ISU adds 1,200 beds, Sauter says that could fall to around 80%.
If you take a young couple who's bought a four-unit building and they're manage it themselves and they're right on a budget, if they lose 10% of their gross income, their taxes stay the same, everything else stays the same, that's gonna hurt those type of people.
On the surface, the off-campus housing market is dominated by big management companies like Young America, SAMU, and First Sight. But those companies are often just managing buildings for an owner, investors like Sauter, who may or may not be able to absorb that revenue loss.
If you have somebody that's highly leveraged and their cash flow is based on a historical 90% occupancy rate and they shift to 80, they're not going to be able to make cash flow, and the banks will be very aggressive on keeping tabs of that.
The overbuilt market is already causing issues. Tom O'Rourke says Redbird Property Management has been converting some of its four-bedroom apartments into two-bedroom units or renting them to just three students looking to attract tenants. He says more vacancies will drive down rent.
We've been on campus 40 years, and we've never had a vacancy, and I'm worried about having vacancies next year.
Another stakeholder hoping to soon learn more is the town of Normal. Up to now, City Manager Pam Reese says the town of Normal hasn't been involved at all in the planning stages or the issuing of ISU's request for proposals for developers. But it's been fielding questions from residents and landlords, like whether ISU is planning to grow enrollment. The answer to that, as a reminder, is no. Normal also has a financial stake in the off-campus market. Those giant apartment buildings are some of the biggest property taxpayers, funding schools and local government operations.
If we have additional housing off-campus that might suddenly not be used by students and be vacant, that's, I think, an important impact on the neighborhoods. So if we understand, what the plans are, I think that helps us adapt a little bit more.
For consumers, disruption isn't always bad. Look no further than ride-sharing apps like Uber and Lyft or short-term rental platforms like Airbnb. They've made traveling way easier, even if they've caused pain for taxi cab companies and hotels. The consumers in this case are ISU students like Angel Zamudio, a junior who's majoring in history and political science. He's also an off-campus senator for the Student Government Association. He's got strong words for landlords.
They kind of use students as like piggy banks, in a sense. Like, they can milk us out for as much as they want, because obviously with the bigger companies, they have that, like, I wouldn't say monopoly because there's like a few of them, but like they tend to act like one because they're like, all right, well, we have these apartment complexes. Let's charge it to whatever price we want. And these students are going to pay for it because they want to live near campus. And I feel like that's kind of like disgusting in a sense, because a lot of these students come from like lower, like for me personally, like I'm from a lower income family, so I don't necessarily have the funds to pay for like a luxurious apartment and all that stuff.
Zamudio is critical of what he sees as predatory practices among local landlords, specifically in creating a false sense of urgency among students to sign leases prematurely. But he's not sold on the new ISU on-campus housing project either. Neither is Kayla Breland, a senior political science major and also an off-campus senator with the Student Government Association. ISU students are required to live on campus their first 2 years, but many sophomores now get an exemption. That's what Breland did. And even if ISU had offered an on-campus sophomore village when she was making her decision, Breland says she still would have moved off campus.
I'm a picky person, so I like nice things. So for that, it was pretty hard. But I really, for me, the big thing of getting out of the dorms was because I didn't like the lack of privacy. I think that really was the hard part, and trying to just find places where real estate companies can really work with you and like sympathize with you as well, your actual individual needs and stuff. So that was, I think that was the hardest part, but I've enjoyed it. Like, I prefer not to be on campus.
Cardinal Court is an ISU student apartment complex that opened in 2012, and it's an option for older students, but it's expensive. ISU's own housing study found that Cardinal Court is priced above the market average. All these dynamics are being considered by potential developers who are required to submit their proposals to ISU by Tuesday. That market evaluation process is key, according to Jamie Wilhelm, Executive Vice President for Public-Private Partnerships with American Campus Communities. That Texas-based company is the largest owner, manager, and developer of student housing communities in the U.S.
We want to make sure that when we build in a market or acquire in a market or partner with a university in a market, that we understand that we have a very deep pool of student residents who can afford to live with us.
The new ISU project will be a public-private partnership like the one that built Cardinal Court. American Campus Communities was involved in that project, by the way. After a set amount of time, ISU would own the new housing development. The total cost of the project is not yet known. ISU's 2018 housing study pegged that cost as between $55 million and $68 million, but that was for 600 to 800 beds, and everything is likely to change with a developer's specific proposal. Jamie Wilhelm says public-private partnerships, or P3s, are increasingly common for these types of projects.
Many institutions are looking at public-private partnerships because they struggle to maintain sufficient reserves to reinvest in their existing infrastructure, housing specifically. And so utilizing a private sector partner, you have the ability to risk transfer that responsibility to the private sector so that as your assets age, they're consistently reinvested in.
He says there are only a handful of national and regional companies that are large enough to compete for these larger 1,200-bed-plus projects. Finalist proposals and presentations will be due in a few weeks, with site visits to follow in the spring. Landlords like Tom O'Rourke and Ed Sauter praise ISU leadership for maintaining strong enrollment, even as other public universities have struggled. But Sauter says real estate is a tough business for him and for the university.
And there will be some damage inflicted, but that's the risk that we know we face as investors. On the other hand, it is in the best interest of ISU to partnership with the private suppliers out there who have faithfully provided housing for years and paid. I'd hate to think of the thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars get paid by local investors. And so this was a little bit of a thorn in everyone's side.
That's local student apartment owner Ed Sauter speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Support for GLT comes from Sangamon Auditorium, presenting one of the world's greatest chamber orchestras, Academy of St. Martin in the Fields with Jeremy Dank on piano, Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. Tickets at uispac.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Illinois Politics Roundtable looks at the complexities of the Illinois minimum wage hike proposal. Bloomington's new deputy city manager, Billy Tyus, says the challenges he helped navigate in Decatur have prepared him for his new job here. Tyus tells GLT's Eric Stock why he walked away from a chance to become city manager in his hometown to take the same job he had in a city where he worked for 18 years.
It's a bit different coming to work at a different place, but it's been, and we're excited about it, absolutely. The staff has been great, very welcoming, have been helping myself and my family with bigger issues, but also the seemingly small. And so it's been a good 2 days. And like I said, we're excited about both the organization and also the community. It's a place that we visit regularly, just as a family anyway, and we've been familiar with the Bloomington community for a while now.
And you were the interim city manager in Decatur after
yes.
Tim Gleason had left to come to Bloomington. Now, presumably, you would have been high on the list of potential successors there in the city where you grew up.
Yeah,
And yet you're here.
I am. A couple of things. One, my wife and myself had discussed relocating for the past couple of years. We remained in Decatur in large part because we liked some of the things that were happening under the leadership of Tim Gleason. And so when he left, things sort of changed, and you know, we started to revisit the thought and idea of relocating. So it's been something that we've been considering for a while now. Never in a million years did I think that I would get the opportunity to come to Bloomington Normal, again, a community that we really, really like a lot and have for a while now, and also to work for Tim Gleason again. So it was like the stars aligned, for lack of a better way to say it, and it was a perfect opportunity, I feel, for myself and my family.
Now, Gleason had said that he was surprised that you had applied for this job, figuring that your next step would be a city manager somewhere.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's a perfect opportunity for us. It's a move from a community that, like I said, we've been in for our entire lives. So it's a good step for us, first of all. But it's also, more importantly, you know, it's a great community. It's a place throughout that's regularly recognized throughout the state as a premier place to live and raise a family. Pair that with the fact that I again get to work for Mr. Gleason, and you know, the fact that this is a great organization, and it seemed like the perfect fit for us. Again, it's as though this opportunity showed up especially for us. I appreciate him thinking that our next step would be for city manager, but again, this is really, really good for us, and we're excited about coming here and raising a family.
So the common question to taking on a new job, what are you doing the first day? You've had your first day in the books, so what's first on the agenda to get acclimated in the new city?
Absolutely. Well, a couple of things. Obviously, they're the obvious organizational HR-related things that you have to do, everything from, you know, paperwork and payroll and things. Getting acclimated to the facilities and the buildings. It's another thing that I'm doing. You know, I really want to get out. Something that's important to me is to get out and meet both the community, but also the our team members. You know, I come in the door with an open mind and open thoughts about both, you know, the positives and maybe the issues that we have to work on. I don't come in with any preconceived notions. It's important to me to get out and listen to folks, both staff and also the community.
What is your sense for what the city does need to work on, or is still keeping ears open for what those are?
Yeah, I do think that it's important to keep your ears open to what those issues are. I would say that cities throughout the state and the country, you know, there's often a perception that, for example, Decatur and Bloomington are markedly different. And there are significant differences, but by the same token, you know, there are very similar issues that we all are dealing with. Things like infrastructure repairs, rising costs, and finding ways to deal with shrinking revenues. Things like that. Figuring out ways to cover costs, again, in that situation. And so there are a lot of issues that are similar. And so hopefully my experience in dealing with some of those will help me in working with Tim and carrying out both his initiatives and directives and also those of the elected officials and continuing to move Bloomington forward.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stogg with Billy Tyus, who is the new deputy city manager in Bloomington. And you bring an outsider's perspective to the city, coming from Decatur, where you were there for close to two decades. You know, the reputation that we've heard at City Hall over the past decade or so, the council is very deliberate. Things tend to move slowly, sometimes not at all. The council is perhaps still a little gun-shy after the issue with the Coliseum and the funding over that. What's your perspective of the city and how government functions here based on your view from about an hour south of here?
I think it's important that elected officials in making decisions, you know, consider all the issues that could be associated with a particular item or an issue. I think when you're dealing with the management of taxpayer dollars, it's important to be deliberate, frankly. In order to make sure that you're making the right decision as it relates to the expenditure of those dollars. Having said that, again, I don't want to form an opinion or a perspective based on maybe things I've read or things that you reference. It's important for me, as in this position, to get in and hear from folks and listen and base how we go forward on those conversations, and so I don't really want to form an opinion based on things I've heard or seen.
Well, let's talk about your passions.
Sure.
And the things that you worked on in Decatur, and talking to Tim Gleason, he had referenced economic development, generally, specifically downtown redevelopment were passions of yours. Any examples of the things that you've done in Decatur that could be transferable here to Bloomington, or other perspectives to help in those areas here?
Sure. Well, the first thing I would like to say is I know that we've got a team in place here that has done a lot of work related to downtown development and some of the other issues that that will come before us. I don't think that any two communities are exactly the same, and while I do think my experience can be helpful here and will be helpful here, I don't want to assume that if there's a cookie cutter one size fits all sort of way to do things. Having said that, I am very, very proud of the downtown work that we did in Decatur. I would say, honestly, having grown up in Decatur, I know that the downtown we have today is nothing like what it was like 5 to 7 years ago. During that period, businesses were closing, and it wasn't a pretty place. I mean, there was infrastructure needs that were necessary. There were other things that needed to happen. Fast forward to today, and downtown Decatur is expanding. There are businesses being added seemingly by the month. On certain days, you can't find parking spaces because the businesses are occupied. And what had happened is that we implemented a $14 million downtown streetscape program that brought the city government did. That brought a new look and feel and energy and excitement to downtown. We invested in new streets. We invested in new sidewalks. We invested in new landscaping and recreational opportunities. And I believe that that was very helpful in helping to bring businesses downtown, everything from new retail and restaurant to new corporate partners. You know, Archer Daniels Midland is one of the city's largest employers, and they have relocated nearly 1,000 employees to the downtown area. And they have said, they and other companies have said, a large reason for why they chose to locate in the downtown area was because of that work that was done. So I don't want to suggest that that's a magic sort of solution to anything. You know, our downtowns are different. We have a different character. But I know that there are ways to assist in the growth and the development of our downtown, and I'm excited about working on things like that with our team.
Well, in looking at the city of Decatur, you said you'd worked there for 18 years, and I think that takes us back to what was a pretty tough time for the city.
Absolutely.
The Bridgestone Firestone plant had closed, a major employer. There was a school brawl that got national attention. It raised a lot of racial tensions in that city. Schools were closing, an outward migration out of the city. What was the mood in the city then at the time when you stepped in, and how do you feel that has changed from there to now, and what role you and the city have helped play to change that?
That's a good question, actually. There are a couple of things. One, those were all things that hit us pretty hard, frankly. I will definitely acknowledge that. The thing that I always say is that I think that in a lot of cases, the outside perception of what was actually happening in our community was a lot worse than what was actually happening. So for example, for sure, you don't want to lose a Bridgestone Firestone. You don't want to see the national attention that we got related to the fight at the school. You don't want those things. But by the same token, there were also other things happening that I believe have led to the Decatur that we see today. So for example, Decatur is a city that builds things. They always will be, they always have been. But they're also almost 70% services based. And so we have been transitioning the economy there so that when you have situations that maybe a facility closes, you're not hit as hard. You know, there are two major hospitals there. I keep saying we because I was there for forever. Two major hospitals there. Caterpillar has added 1,000 jobs there. Like I said, our healthcare facilities are growing. And so I believe that the city during this period, in partnership with community partners, worked hard to really to weather those storms. And I think that the Decatur of today is you wouldn't recognize it necessarily from what it was in the past. And so, and I think that a lot of that had to do with the partnerships that exist in that community.
And we're visiting with new Bloomington Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus as he starts a new job this week. So what do you want the residents of the city of Bloomington to know first and foremost about you?
Hopefully that there's a feeling that I am accessible. I am. I come in the door realizing that it is my job to carry out the wishes and the initiatives of the city manager and the elected officials here and the needs of the Bloomington community. You know, it's important as a government, in my opinion, to not assume that we know necessarily what is best and that we hear from the people in this community, that we are transparent in the work that we do. We are transparent in you know, our operations. And we hear from the public in order to decide what it is that we want to see in this community. It's their community. We're here to carry out their wishes and needs and desires. And so hopefully that is how I come across to the people of this community, because that is who I am. And again, I keep using the word excited. I'm ecstatic about this opportunity.
Lastly, are you going to offer any sort of olive branch to Decatur? Because first, Bloomington takes their city manager, and then they take their long-serving deputy city manager in about 6 months' time.
You know, Decatur was very, very good to me. Decatur helped me to prepare for this opportunity. I'm thankful. I'm grateful. I am, you know, I don't end up here if it's not for the love and the support that Decatur has given me over the course of my life. My family's still there. We'll be there a lot. My mom's still there. And so, you know, I just want to offer thanks more than anything else to the Decatur community for all that they've done for me.
That's Bloomington Deputy City Manager Billy Tyeth with GLT's Eric Stock. The city is hosting a meet and greet for Tyeth at City Hall this afternoon from 5 to 6, just before the City Council meeting.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, presenting complimentary breakfast quarterly to help individuals set goals and expectations for senior living communities. Next breakfast, Tuesday, March 5th at 9 a.m. Karen is available at 557-8004 to RSVP by February 26th. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, there are still lots of concerns about marijuana and the potential legalization of it. We'll have an IPR report on one community and its reaction. The bill to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour has cleared the Illinois Senate, but is it a done deal in the House? The Illinois Politics Roundtable dives into the question and the complex details of the Senate version of the bill. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and IPR's Brian Mackey and Jacqueline Driscoll. Driscoll has reported on the issue as it moved through the Senate.
So it will incrementally or step by step increase the minimum wage in Illinois over a six-year process. It would be from 2020 we would see the first dollar increase. That would move to July of 2020 where you would see a 75-cent increase. And then annually, every year on January 1, there will be another dollar increase. So eventually taking up the minimum wage to $15 by 2025.
And I think there are some other aspects of this legislation. Isn't there some type of tax credit for businesses, certain smaller businesses?
Yes, there is. That was an issue that was addressed. Obviously, Republicans were saying that this is going to be hard for businesses, especially downstate, who are trying to meet their bottom lines. They won't be able to keep up with paying their workers so much money. So that was kind of a response to make it easier on them as they absorb the costs.
Brian, when we hear the $15 minimum wage, I know a lot of people get excited about that. We're talking 6 years for it to get to that point. So that's not a, you know, necessarily a fast movement to get to that level.
Yeah, don't start making any extravagant purchase considerations yet. It's interesting to me. We're talking 6 years. It's not going to be until January 1st of 2025 when it'll be $15 an hour. Inflation will continue to happen during that time. And this, you know, fight for 15 started a good number of years ago at this point. That's the movement backed by a lot of labor unions and activists to raise the minimum wage level. And, you know, I almost wonder if by the time we get to January 1st, 2025, $15 will seem like maybe $12 or $11 does today. And that's the issue. You know, the minimum wage in Illinois has not increased in almost about a decade now. somebody can
2010.
Correct me.
2010. Yep.
2010. Yeah. Okay. So almost 10 years. So this is something where I expect we will continue hearing about this this fight in future years.
And that was actually something that was addressed at the press conference with Governor Pritzker after the Senate did pass the minimum wage increase. They were touting it as we're pulling these people out of poverty. But as State Senator Kimberly Lightford, the sponsor of this measure, indicated in a committee hearing, $15 minimum wage is needed right now. By the time we get to 2025, $15 is still going to be keeping people in poverty. So technically, it's not really pulling these people out of poverty as they were touting.
And Charlie, we'd said it's been since 2010 since it's gone up in Illinois. That being said, it's still higher than the federal minimum wage. And some towns, like Chicago, has raised the minimum wage that that's paid in that city.
Yeah, they're already committed to the $15, and so is Cook County, to a higher minimum wage. And the argument that was made on the Senate floor by Republicans and a few downstate Democrats was that it costs a lot more to live in Chicago in the suburbs than it does in southern Illinois or in western Illinois, and some parts of central Illinois, rural areas. So there really needs to be some kind of differential. And the impact is going to be felt more keenly by small business, which doesn't have the ability to spread its costs over a wide range of enterprises. Say somebody like Walmart has stores all over the country, and they can spread it out. Mom and pop operating the local grocery store can't do that. I don't even know if there are any local grocery stores anymore. But the small business, the argument is, will suffer more, particularly downstate. And I think that's why the tax credit was put in. And basically what it allows, and it only applies to smaller companies, those with 50 or fewer full-time employees, and it allows them to reduce the amount of withholding from employees that they have to submit to the state. And in the first year of the higher wage, the calendar year 2020, 25% of the income tax that they withheld or that they will withhold from their employees, they get to keep. And just 75% goes back to the state. Now, the employee, of course, gets credit for the full withholding. And that was seen as a way to mitigate the impact. And it gets gradually reduced so that ultimately it's kind of phased out when the minimum wage is fully implemented.
Now, there are people who are trying to raise a family, as we've heard, who are making minimum wage. There's also high school kids, for example, their first job. And because they're being paid minimum wage, they might get access to jobs. I could imagine that some people might say, you know, I can't see paying a high schooler that amount. There is some provision in there for people. Is it 16 and 17-year-olds?
Yes, and they will be capped. Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, because this was something that you reported on, but I believe that was $13 an hour the teenagers will be capped at.
Yeah, ultimately, that's not until 2025. Currently, they make 50 cents less than people who are of age, 18 years and older. And this not only caps the amount at $2 less than the 15 wage, they'll be capped at 13, but it raises it more slowly. So at the beginning of next year, when older people will be making $9.25 an hour, teenagers, youths will still be making $8 an hour.
Now, getting through the Senate, it seemed to me like that was maybe not the toughest challenge for this legislation. The big fight may be coming in the Illinois House, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of different lobby groups on different sides of this who are going to be weighing in. But I've heard different numbers thrown about how much this will actually cost government, because, of course, there are some people in some, you know, higher education institutions, for example, that hire students, things like that. You know, what do we know regarding the actual cost of this to the state of Illinois?
Well, we heard from a lot of Republicans, Senate Republicans particularly, while they were debating the bill on the floor, saying that this is going to be a huge impact, especially those senators who are in college towns with ISU, with U of I. We heard from Senator Jason Berrickman. We heard from Senator Chapin Rose, but also, you know, not even just the government, but the taxpayers. They're also saying that this is going to be really hard for local school districts. One superintendent saying this is basically mandating us to raise property taxes on the people who live in our district. So there is that argument there that it's going to be a lot of additional cost.
And Charlie, that's logical. There will be an issue. Somebody's got to pay it.
Oh, yeah. But on the other hand, the folks who are at that level, and there was a study done by an institute at University of Illinois Chicago called the Illinois Economic Policy Institute, and it points out that 60% of the people who are getting minimum wage now are 30 years or older. Half of them have kids, so it's not just teenage workers. And what I think is interesting is these people are going to be earning more in their communities. Now, at their level of income, they're not going to be putting it in some offshore banking account in the Cayman Islands. They're going to be spending it right there in town. So there's going to be a positive economic benefit, too. Now, the winners and losers will vary, but overall, it's not necessarily going to be a big drain on the economy.
Brian, what do we know about the Illinois House right now? Like Speaker Madigan, is he on board with this idea?
He told his caucus this week that he would support the minimum wage legislation. Now, I think it remains to be seen whether that will be in the exact form that it passed the Senate. We know that the governor and Senate Democrats really want the speaker to sort of let this come up and go through just the way they did it. They're in a hurry to get this thing signed. On the other hand, Speaker Madigan has been among Democrats willing to hear out, if not outright sympathetic, to the concerns of the business community. And so I think that we're going to have to wait and see how this proceeds through the House.
Well, that's IPR State House Editor Brian Mackey with other members of the Illinois Politics Roundtable, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Jacqueline Driscoll of IPR, and moderator Sean Crawford. A House committee considers the minimum wage bill this week. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a shortage of referees for youth games in Illinois. When talking about legalizing recreational marijuana in the state, the conversation has shifted from if to when. Still, many residents have both questions and concerns. Lawmakers pushing for a legalized program held a meeting in Springfield where they attempted to clear up confusion and gather feedback from residents. IPR's Jacqueline Driscoll attended and has more.
It was a full house in the Carnegie Room of the Lincoln Library. It was a diverse group filled with advocates, members of the medical cannabis community, the new director of agriculture, and just regular people. State Senator Heather Staines and Representative Kelly Cassidy, both Chicago Democrats, are leading the charge for a recreational cannabis program in Illinois. Before they took questions, they laid out what they are actually proposing.
This will allow Illinois residents ages 21 and over to purchase and possess up to 30 grams of cannabis. We maintain the ability for local governments to opt out. We maintain the ability for employers to maintain drug-free workplace. Landlords can restrict access as well.
And hammering home time and time again.
Our goal here really is to make it that people want to go and buy in the legal market. It's a better, safer product. You can't get access to teens, and we really want to have that illicit market go away.
Oftentimes, when folks talk about legalizing cannabis, they associate that with tax revenue. But Cassidy says that's not what this is about, and it shouldn't be.
Fundamentally, if you're doing this to bring in money, you're doing it wrong, you're going to bring in less money. It is really that simple.
The questions from the audience were written on comment cards and were anonymous. They were often bunched together because so many of them were the same. State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Bunker Hill, hosted the event and led the discussion.
A lot of questions I get from constituents in the office is, what does this do in terms of impaired driving? And then secondary, how is that enforced? She touched on this in the presentation, but how is enforcement going to happen?
So first and foremost, when we talk about these things, it's important to remember, let's go back to those numbers, there are roughly 700,000 people using this product without access to a cannabis card today. The people who are using the product today are the people that are going to be using the product under a legalized structure. So it's happening now, and we're not doing a great job of it. The data that we've seen, and we've seen conflicting studies. I can give you a study to prove any conclusion. A lot of what you hear, you end up hearing X went up 500%, but if you read the methodology, they weren't measuring before. When we met with the folks from Colorado on one of our first hearings, she could not emphasize that enough. All of the studies that are coming out that talk about these increases are going from 0 to 10. When you didn't have that thing measured the year before, you can't say that it increased by 500%. Your knowledge of it increased.
Another big concern, underage use. How do you keep it out of the hands of teens?
What penalties will be included, if any, in the bill that would target those who supply cannabis to minors?
That will remain illegal. That's illegal today. It will remain illegal. Right now, if a teen is caught drinking, their license can be taken away from them.
Until they're 21.
Until they're of age. Right now, that's not in place for cannabis. If a teen is found smoking cannabis, they don't lose their license. We're going to change that as on the bill, so that if, in fact, they're found smoking, their license will be taken away until they're 21.
And what about people who've been arrested for marijuana possession in the past? The sponsors say they want to reverse the harm caused by the war on drugs. Cassidy says while the proposal attempts to do that, the process has actually already begun.
Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox actually announced last week that she's going to begin the process of expunging records already, absent the change in the law. We intend for that to have a statewide impact as well.
Lawmakers hope to file a measure soon, and they have high hopes it'll pass with bipartisan support. Still, there's plenty of details to be worked out, like how to effectively tax the product without driving buyers back to an illicit market, where the tax revenue will go, and how to expand opportunity for people who want to get into the industry. It's clear there's a lot more negotiating that will need to take place before Illinoisans see an actual bill. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In sports, officials are at their best when their work goes unnoticed, but organizers of youth and high school sports in Illinois have seen the supply of people willing to don the stripes has dwindled when demand for officials has never been higher. Illinois High School Association records show a 21% drop in licensed officials in the last 5 years. GLT's Eric Stock looks into what it takes to become an official and why, even in a sports-crazed society, it's a call fewer are answering.
Scott Kerr recalls working a postseason high school basketball game at a packed gym 2 years ago. He assessed a technical foul against a player at a key moment in the game, and he heard about it from one fan in particular.
You know, we're going down the court, and a guy from the team that was down, that's technical, was against, started referencing my weight and telling me I wasn't a good official because I was fat and out of shape and I couldn't get up and down the floor, and I thought I was doing a good job.
Kerr works in jail security. The 14-year veteran official who lives in Mansfield shrugged off the snide comment, but it appears that kind of vitriol has prompted more officials to walk away from the games they love or, in some cases, never get started.
Terry Kent and I are here to administer the rules. Part of that is we expect good behaviors, and as leaders for your team, we expect that you're going to help.
Derek Sig is president of the Bloomington Normal Officials Association.
Good luck, have fun.
He's been donning the whistle for 33 years, calling basketball, football, baseball, softball, and more recently, volleyball. He sees the attrition problem firsthand.
We need to fill the shoes of those that are retiring, and we don't have enough that are either coming on board or staying on board. We can get plenty of them started, but after about 3 years, they tend to drop off. We can't really keep them involved in that.
Come on! Where's the foul?
Unfortunately, the fans become part of it. And for whatever reason, the fans have just become more vocal. And there are just some people that don't know how to tolerate it. They really shouldn't have to tolerate it.
Sig says some schools have canceled junior varsity baseball and softball games because they can't find umpires. Another coping mechanism for a Friday night official gap is to move some football games to Saturdays when more officials are willing to work. Sig says he and others can slough off a certain kind of complaint.
You know, I'm going to admit I yell at the TV sometimes too, but try to refrain when I'm actually there in person because I understand that that's a difficult position to be in, and you can't always be in perfect position. You just try to get in the best position you can, and you can't see everything. And there are times where a fan has a better angle than the officials do.
The problem, Sig says, is when the ref abuse gets personal.
There may be some places you go where fans know you, either through work or other community experiences, and they start to call you by name, or you've got fans that will just continually yell.
Come on, jump ball!
May or may not know what they're talking about.
Sig says the association offers mentoring to young officials so they don't quit. Official Scott Kerr says the need to fast-track more young officials to fill the gap and cover higher-profile games amplifies the fan abuse problem.
Now, I mean, we got guys working varsity-level basketball their second or third year, and maybe even their first year if, you know, if it's needed. And that's good that they're willing to do it, but they'll also tell you that they're not prepared for it.
All officials start somewhere. In McLean County, many begin at Game Time Gym 2 in Bloomington. It hosts basketball tournaments from third grade to adult and hosts adult volleyball and recreational badminton and pickleball. The venue demonstrates how youth sports has grown into a major industry in the U.S. During its peak season from October to March, owner Larry McDowell says he needs to fill 100 official game slots every weekend, his biggest challenge in the business.
100% hardest part. Because the number of refs you need, the shortage of officials, the time it takes to train them, the time it takes to, you know, to schedule them, it's not their full-time job.
Game Time Gym pays officials between $10 and $18 per game. They do it for the experience or for the love of the game. McDowell says many officials are new to the craft and are working their way up. McDowell typically starts them reffing third grade games, the youngest level of competitive basketball, where they are not the only ones learning.
So it's just the perfect storm at that level where new officials, special rules, kids not making a basketball move, that you're trying to understand, and do I make a call? And then the expectation of the parents and the coaches is we have to have a quality official at that level. And we accept that, right? But it is extremely difficult.
Third graders have special rules since basketball skills are underdeveloped at that age. The Illinois High School Association has kept its eye on the shrinking official roles, but doesn't consider it a crisis yet. Sam Knox oversees officials for the IHSA. He says the number of licensed officials in the state has dropped from about 14,000 5 years ago to nearly 11,000 this year. That's a 21% drop in 5 years. Knox notes it's part of a national trend.
We've got a lot of officials who have been with us for 30 or 40 years and still go out and officiate basketball three or four nights a week, and they're telling us we're getting tired. We need somebody to back us up and come in and take our spot.
Knox says the IHSA has stepped up recruiting efforts. Several high schools and colleges offer classes in sports officiating, and the association is encouraging more schools to add it. Another barrier, though, is startup costs that can be hundreds of dollars. IHSA licensing costs $50 and $15 for each additional sport. Officials also buy their uniforms, hats, shoes, chest protectors, and other gear. They even have to buy their own whistles. Some official associations, including the one in Bloomington Normal, offer financial help and sometimes hold garage sales so refs can gear up at a lower cost. Refs recoup costs depending on how often they want to work, but it's not really a money-making proposition. Hutt Venerable is athletic director at Central Catholic High School in Bloomington. His school pays officials $50 for a freshman game, $60 for junior varsity, and $70 for varsity. Venerable coached Normal Community to a state football title in 2006. He recently returned to Bloomington after serving as football coach and AD at suburban Lincoln Way Central. Venerable says the official shortage is greater in central Illinois than in the Chicago area. He says officials face many of the same obstacles that coaches face. He has seen many coaches and officials walk away at much younger ages than they used to, and he understands why.
Long hours, not a lot of pay, sacrificing time away from your family. Nowadays, everything's under a microscope. I think there's challenges that may... So you really appreciate these guys that, and these guys and gals that are doing it.
Venerable says he hasn't noticed a significant change in fan behavior going back to his college days in the 1970s.
We identify more of the negative now because we have social media. And so word travels fast more about the negative situations that do crop up. But I think fans have always just been passionate about basketball in this state.
Venerable has sought to remove the potential for negative situations. When he was hired at Central Catholic in 2017, he adopted a sportsmanship code that comes with a pregame announcement that the public address announcer reads before every sporting event.
Support and show your appreciation for the efforts of both teams.
Official Scott Kerr says he would like to see athletic directors be more proactive in removing unruly fans. He plans to work as long as he can, but he understands why others are hanging it up.
Why should I go out, spend an hour and a half of my evening, and just go out there and just get yelled at by coaches and fans?
At 32, Kerr is one of the youngest officials he knows. He says the relationship between refs and fans will always have conflict, but he thinks many coaches have become more sympathetic as they see fewer refs joining the ranks.
A lot of the guys I work with are younger, so they're like, hey, we got to be nice to these guys. They're going to be around longer, you know, and it's going to be a long career for both of us if we can't seem to get along.
The IHSA's Sam Knox, a licensed official himself, says he empathizes with those refs who say they've had enough, but he encourages them to tune out the noise.
Officials have to have some degree of thick skin and not have the rabbit ears. And you hear those comments, and sometimes you kind of chuckle inside when people say the repeated comments time after time, gym after gym. But you have to find a way to tune that out and focus on the game.
Knox says the IHSA has a rating system for its officials that determine which ones are awarded postseason and state finals assignments. The system factors in licensing level, test scores, previous postseason experience, and coaches' ratings. He says officials are also generally good at self-evaluation as they try to hone their craft.
No official tries to make mistakes, just like no kid tries to fumble the football or miss a layup or strike out. Everybody tries their best to do a really, really good job. And believe me, officials know when they've done a poor job.
Knox urges parents and fans to have a little empathy for people doing a tough job. He says the biggest ref shortages are in wrestling, soccer, and track and field. I'm Eric Stock.
The NCAA has tried to clamp down on coaches protesting officials' calls by allowing them to assess a technical foul against a coach who gestures in a way that a ref could perceive as disrespectful. Illinois State men's basketball coach Dan Muller was recently reprimanded by the Missouri Valley Conference for criticizing officials who gave him a technical during a January game at Bradley. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and to Eric Stock and Ryan Denham for today's show. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is GLT.